What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The Pentagon confirms 6 U.S. service members killed by a suicide bomber Monday in an attack on a NATO patrol near Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack, claiming 19 deaths, but the Taliban has been known to exaggerate casualty numbers. NATO says it is investigating the attack. VOA's Ayaz Ghul reports from the location.
This area north of Kabul has been the base of Hizb-e-Islami, another militant group which is led by former Afghan Prime Minister Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who is obviously wanted by the United States. So this area in Afghanistan has been a strong base of Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. So mixing up with the population and getting support from the local population for the Taliban is not difficult. So it is quite possible someone from within the population not far from the Bagram Air Base might have helped the Taliban to carry out this attack.
VOA's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. President Barack Obama is expressing confidence those opposing the Islamic State group will prevail, but there will be significant progress before he leaves office. In an interview with NPR News released Monday, Mr. Obama called the Islamic State a virulent, nasty organization.
It is also important for us to keep things in perspective. And this is not an organization that can destroy the United States. This is not a huge industrial power that can pose great risks to us institutionally or in a systematic way.
The president stressed that the U.S. would triumph. This is VOA News. Opposition activists in Djibouti say as many as 19 people died today when security forces opened fire on a religious gathering in the capital. Witnesses said the troops targeted a crowd in the Balbala neighborhood commemorating the late religious leader Sheikh Yonis Muz. Security forces raided the venue around 5 a.m. local time and began shooting, according to sources. A reporter for VOA in Djibouti says more than 10 people were wounded in addition to those killed. Deposed FIFA president Sepp Blatter says he'll be back after the Ethics Committee of Football's governing body banned him and Michel Platini, head of the Union of European Football Association, from the sport for 8 years. The committee took the action after Blatter and Platini. Apparently, there was a payment that Blatter made to Platini in 2011. Swiss prosecutors have opened a criminal investigation into the payment. Blatter says the $2 million was evidence of an oral contract with Platini. FIFA judges said the evidence of such a contract was not convincing and therefore was rejected. The Russian military says it's been unable to retrieve information from the flight data recorder recovered from a warplane shot down by Turkey last month. The head of Russia's military flight safety service said an inspection of the recorder shows 13 of 16 microchips nearly ruined, the others damaged, and pulling information from them will take time. Some observers see Turkey's current crises with Russia, as well as Iraq and Iran, as evidence of a strategic change in Ankara. For generations, Turkey has avoided intervention in the affairs of its neighbors. But as Dorian Jones reports, these days Ankara is taking a more assertive approach.
Turkey remains one of the strongest backers of the Syrian rebels and loudest voices for the overthrow of Syria's president Bashar al-Assad. Early this month, it dispatched tanks and soldiers to Iraq without Baghdad's permission. While Turkey insists it remains committed to respecting the territorial integrity of its neighbours, its actions indicate it has abandoned a decades-long foreign policy, says Aydin Selicin, a retired Turkish diplomat who opened Turkey's first consulate in Iraqi Kurdistan.
What we do in Syria, helping some militias trying to topple Assad, and what we are doing in Iraq is quite an interventionist foreign policy based on, let's say, values or, in certain cases, in natural interest.
Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The United States added 2 species of lions in Africa to its endangered list Monday, a move that will make it more difficult for hunters to bring trophies from the wildlife back into the country. The Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages the list, says it was prompted by declining populations in the wild and the need to ensure those who illegally hunt cannot gain from their actions. One lion species found in central and western parts of Africa as well as India has a population estimated at 1,400 in the wild. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burkina Faso authorities have issued an arrest warrant for former President Blaise Compaoré for his alleged role in Thomas Sankara's assassination.
On behalf of the family, I think it is sort of satisfaction because during the 27 years of Blaise Compaoré, we introduced a request for truth and justice for Thomas Sankara's and others' assassinations.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Thomas Sankara. Zimbabwe is today observing 28 years since the signing of a unity peace agreement. Passenger trains are again running in Kampala, and South Sudanese react to the return of the first rebel advance team.
People have been waiting for them to come. This will change the policies in the country. It will change the people's feelings. And also it is a step towards confident building in a broken society like South Sudan.
Andrew Akoni Ayom is the chief whip for the SPLMDC, South Sudan's main political party. The release of two men charged with sodomy has sparked a debate about the country's anti-homosexuality law in Malawi, and FIFA President Sepp Blatter will challenge his 8-year suspension. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A family member of the late iconic Burkina Faso President Thomas Sankara says the family has come one more step closer to getting justice for Sankara's untimely death, which took place during a 1987 military coup led by now exiled former President Blaise Compaoré. On Monday, the new Burkina Faso government issued an international arrest warrant for former President Compaoré for his alleged role in the killing of Sankara. Compaoré fled into exile earlier this year after he was overthrown by a popular uprising and is believed to be living either in Morocco or Ivory Coast. Paul Sankara, the younger brother of the late Thomas Sankara, says he hopes the government of Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara will extradite Mr. Compaoré for the sake of the long-standing relations between Burkina Faso and Cote d'Ivoire.
On behalf of the family, I think it is sort of satisfaction because during the 27 years of Blaise Compaoré, we introduced a request for truth and justice for Thomas Sankara's and others' assassinations. Through the transitional government in Burkina Faso from October 2014 until now, they have been done quite a good job in terms of doing a process through the justice in Burkina Faso to have the truth and justice on Thomas' assassination. So, yeah, it's a satisfaction. We're not at the end of the process yet, but in 27 years, we can say that it's a satisfaction.
This means now that Compaoré and Gilbert Diendéré, who was your late brother's chief of staff, both now have been charged.
Absolutely. Gilbert Diendéré, general who did the coup d'etat attempt September of this year, he is now in jail for the same charge that Blaise Compaoré should respond to. That's why I think it's logical to repatriate Blaise Compaoré from Ivory Coast, where he's living in exile right now.
Let's assume that Blaise Compaoré is living in Cote d'Ivoire, as the reports indicate. Do you think the government of the Ivory Coast will be willing to let him go?
Yes, but it involves the former president of Ivory Coast, Oufuette Boigny, through the different articles and, those who wrote some articles and books on Thomas' assassination and the revolution in Burkina Faso with Thomas Sankara. Above Blaise Compaoré and the former president, it's a question of the future of the two countries. The best diplomatic approach of the government of Ivory Coast should be to maybe have a sort of negotiation in order to keep the good relationship between the two countries. And I'm pretty sure the government of Ivory Coast, for the sake of the historical relationship between the people of Ivory Coast and the people of Burkina Faso, the government of Ivory Coast would have a positive reaction about the request to send Blaise Compaoré back in Burkina Faso.
That brings me to the current government of Burkina Faso, the newly elected president. I mean, based on what we know, I was thinking that perhaps the new government may not be willing to go after Blaise Compaoré because the new president also had connection with Blaise Compaoré. Are you satisfied with the action that's being taken?
Yes, it has been said that they were part of the establishment of the 27 years regime of Blaise Compaoré, the new elected president. At the same time, they have something more powerful than what Blaise Compaoré may represent, which is the people of Burkina Faso. The people of Burkina Faso, especially the youth and civil society movements, they will work until they get the truth and justice for Thomas Sankara.
Paul Sankara is the junior brother of the late Burkina Faso president Thomas Sankara. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. South Sudanese opposition lawmakers and officials with the Joint Peace Monitoring and Evaluation Commission have been reacting positively to yesterday's arrival in Juba of the first phase of the rebel advance team. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Opposition politicians applauded the SPLM-IO advance team's arrival to Juba, calling it a significant step towards implementing the peace agreement signed in August by the leaders of the two warring parties. Andrew Okony-Ayom, chief whip for South Sudan's main opposition party, the SPLM-DC, describes the arrival as a golden opportunity to finally turn things around in South Sudan.
People have been waiting for them to come, and their coming actually is overdue, should have been earlier a bit. This will change the policies in the country. It will change the people's feelings. And also it is a step towards confident building in a broken society like South Sudan.
Okony says South Sudanese suffered greatly from the nearly 2 years long conflict and says implementing the peace deal is the only way to end the suffering of innocent civilians. Opposition lawmaker Bol Tobe Madut, who is Secretary for Parliamentary Affairs with the opposition, Sudan African National Union Party, says now that the advance team has arrived, he is now optimistic that the agreement will be implemented.
The ordinary person knows now that there's no warring parties. Once they know the SPLM-IO, they're here. They will know the family of South Sudan is all together now within the country. And we can all now face the difficulties and the challenges and the development that we need for our nation together.
Ali Velsh, spokesperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, says people can now start to see what they have been hoping for. An end to war.
It's symbolically very important that we can now say truly implementation is taking place and is moving forward with the necessary pace. It's been a difficult process, as you know, to get everybody back here, to get agreement for all of the various steps that are required. This is the start of the return, it's not the end of the return.
JMEC, which is headed by former Botswana President Festus Mogae, is responsible for overseeing the implementation of the agreement and the permanent ceasefire in South Sudan. JMEC is composed of officials from the warring parties, society groups, and representatives from IGAD countries. It will supervise the ceasefire monitoring mechanism and the constitutional review process, among other things. The two parties are expected to begin talks in Juba tomorrow. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
Zimbabweans are today, Tuesday, commemorating 28 years since the signing of a peace accord between the ruling ZANU-PF, led by President Robert Mugabe, and the opposition PF-ZAPU, led then by the late Joshua Nkomo, which ended hostilities between the two parties. But the opposition movement for democratic change, led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, is downplaying the outcome of the agreement, saying 28 years on, that Zimbabwe is not at peace. Party spokesman Obra Gutu, however, tells Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe service that the party will still observe the day.
As the MDC led by Morgan Tsvangirai, we actually are very sad to say that instead of calling it Unity Day, this day should actually be called Disunity Day. We see that the country is polarized. The country is deeply divided. We even notice that the ruling party itself, ZANU-PF, is in a serious state of fractionalized condition. We see that there is no peace and harmony. We see that each and every day people are being fired from government. The people are being fired from ZANU-PF. We see that there is total disrespect for the values and ethos that Father Zimbabwe, Dr. Joshua Nkomo, fought for. So as the MDC, we are saying the Unity Day celebration is actually a celebration that should not be held, because at the end of the day, there is no unity to talk about.
Have you ever recognized this day as a party?
As a party, the NDC has never had any reason to observe the Unity Day, in the sense that that unity was supposed to be a unity between the former ZAPU and ZANU-PF. But we also realized that the former ZAPU was actually not united with ZANU-PF. What happened is that ZANU bludgeoned ZAPU into submission through the Gokurahundi massacres of the mid to the late 1980s in the Matabeleland provinces and the parts of the Midlands. We see that the hero that he was, Dr. Joshua Ngomo, just saw it fit to reluctantly agree to a so-called unity accord just to save his people from being further massacred at the brutal ZANU-PF killing machine.
Spokesman Oba Gutu of the opposition MDC formation led by former Prime Minister Moki Shangarai speaking from Mauritius with Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe service. Today is Tuesday, December 22nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Traffic is a universal problem for Africa's mushrooming urban centers, but Uganda is trying a new approach. For the first time in three decades, passenger trains are once again chugging and in and out of the Kampala train station, but this time they are bringing in commuters from a suburb outside the capital. Sujino Rusbla has more.
This is a normal rush hour in Kampala. Compared to the streets, the train station is rather quiet. City officials hope that this will change.
There's been need for us to move the commuter passengers within the city so that we're able to reduce the jam that we really see, especially during the peak hours, both in the morning and the evening.
Kampala hasn't had commuter trains since 1992, when private minibuses called matatus took over the streets. The new train service is just one line, making three stops between the city center and the area of Namanve.
More comfortable and to bring me nearer to my workplace. It's also cheaper than the taxis and the buses.
I'm fed up of the jam on the road. The jam used on road for over 2 hours. Just to get in Kampala, but here I only take only 40 minutes. Yet the fares are also fair, let me say. 1.5 as compared to 2.5. A difference of 1,000 shillings.
Since the 1970s, Kampala's population has exploded. Most people live outside the city. In just the last decade, the number of people in the suburbs has doubled to 2 million. The jams have become the top challenge. This new train line is a test to find a permanent solution.
It's going to be a pilot project for 1 year. It's going to help us really be able to get the required information, the data that we can use, so that we're able to get to a full-scale, operation.
In 1 year, the Ugandan Railway Corporation is hoping to transport 10,000 people, a challenge as people haven't exactly been flooding to the rails during the first week. Taxis and minibuses are simply more convenient for some people, at least for now. The train is the second project the city government has launched to curb traffic. In May, city buses started to run and their popularity is slowly picking up. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Kampala.
Malawi has released two men charged with sodomy. The move has sparked fierce debate as religious leaders and politicians accuse the government of bowing to demands from the international community. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
Malawi suspended a law criminalizing homosexual acts in 2012, pending a parliament review. That law, which lays out maximum jail sentence of 14 years, was seen by some to be in conflict with the constitution, which calls for respect for human rights. But the parliamentary review never happened, and the law remains on the books. It was used to charge two men arrested on December 7. Those charges were dropped Saturday. Malawi's Justice Minister Samuel Tembenu says the law remains suspended.
We are responding to the concerns that people have had, that we have breached our international obligations. So people were complaining, especially the international community.
International watchdog group Human Rights Watch and the American and German embassies had condemned the men's arrest. Religious leaders are now denouncing their unconditional release. Reverend Morris Montali is the spokesman for the Presbyterian Church in Livingstonia. He says homosexuality is a sin.
It is disgusting that a nation can succumb to the dictates of donors and in the process losing our identity, our spiritual trust, and our tradition.
Bide Banda, the director of a local good governance group, Malawi Watch, says the government took a rash decision. It would have been appropriate, he said, to push for an emergency session of parliament to decide once and for all on the anti-homosexuality law.
It is unfair, very unfair. When you're talking about human rights, we're not talking about minorities. There are majority rights issues as well. And what we're asking now, government must rescind that moratorium. It is uncultural.
The issue is quickly becoming a political hot potato for the ruling party. Spokesman for the lead opposition coalition, the Malawi Congress Party, reportedly told a local media the government should prioritize on the welfare of poor Malawians over issues involving one or two people. Political lecture at the University of Malawi, Boniface Dulani.
When you look at the survey numbers, you see that up to 95% of Malawians disapprove of homosexuality. So one of the things that this decision can make is it also politically it might cost the government some support.
The government tried to strike a balance Saturday, releasing a statement that it is committed to reviewing the anti-homosexuality law, but with consultation with the people of Malawi. The public has resisted two previous attempts to change the homosexuality law. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The embattled president of World Football's governing body, FIFA, Sepp Blatter, is pledging to fight an 8-year ban from all football-related activities that was imposed by the organization's ethics committee. The 3-man FIFA panel applied a similar ban on the head of European soccer, Michel Platini. Lisa Schleyer reports for VOA from Geneva.
FIFA President Sepp Blatter was in a combative mood when he faced journalists shortly after he received word of his suspension by the Ethics Committee.
I'm sorry that I am, as president of FIFA, this punching ball, and I'm sorry for football. I regret that I'm this punching ball there. I regret for my organization that I have served with heart and conscience during 41 years, but specifically I regret, and I'm there for all the members, the team members working in FIFA.
FIFA's ethics committee found Blatter and UEFA President Michel Platini guilty of ethics code breaches regarding an unauthorized payment of $2 million by the president of FIFA to Platini. Swiss prosecutors are conducting a criminal investigation into these allegedly illegal payments. Both men deny wrongdoing. Blatter says he thought he had convinced the panel of the tribunal that the FIFA payment to Platini was legitimate. He says the tribunal has accused him and Platini of lying, but it has proven nothing.
But something what is not true cannot be proven. And if it cannot be proven, cannot be guilty. I am now suspended 8 years. Suspended 8 years. But I will fight. I will fight for me and I will fight for FIFA.
Blatter says he will take his case to the FIFA Appeals Committee and the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Blatter has been FIFA president since 1998. He is supposed to step down on February 26th. If the 8-year suspension holds, Blatter notes he will not even be allowed to attend the Congress. Platini has been widely tipped as the new FIFA chief, but this long-held ambition is likely to be derailed if his suspension is not lifted and he's not cleared of all charges. FIFA has been mired in scandal since May when 14 FIFA officials were arrested in Zurich and charged in the United States with nearly 50 counts of corruption, including racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And here is Marco Uma with the rest of Daybreak Africa Sports reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on football. Suspended FIFA President Joseph Sepp Blatter and suspended FIFA Vice President Michel Platini are with immediate effect banned from all football-related activities for 8 years. The FIFA Ethics Committee Adjudicatory Chamber Chair Hans-Joachim Eckert disclosed in Zurich, Switzerland on Monday. In addition, Blatter is fined over $50,000 and Platini over $80,000. According to Eckert, the penalties are imposed after Blatter authorized FIFA's payment to Platini of over $2 million in February 2011 with no legal basis in a written contract between the two. Eckert notes this is a violation of the FIFA Code of Ethics as it pertains to bribery and corruption. Blatter and Platini may now lodge an appeal with the FIFA Appeals Committee. If they are not satisfied with the verdict, they are at liberty to plead their case before the Court of Arbitration in Sports, CAS. CAS is the world's highest authority in arbitrating sports disputes. Its ruling is binding on all parties. Staying with Platini, the ban on Platini almost certainly puts an end to any hope of him pursuing the FIFA presidential elections on the 26th of February next year. For almost a year, certain prominent European media houses have claimed Platini is favored to win the election without showing evidence to back their theory. Currently, 5 candidates are cleared to contest the FIFA presidential elections. These are Jordan's Prince Ali bin Al Hussein, Switzerland's Gianni Infantino, Frenchman Jerome Champagne, Kuwait's Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa, and South Africa's Tokyo Sekwale. The Court of Arbitration in Sport has yet to publicly pronounce its verdict regarding an appeal by the Liberia Football Association president Musa Bility, who lodged an appeal with CAS after FIFA declined to clear him to stand for the FIFA presidential elections. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. This is our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, December 22nd.
This is Dr. Adenares from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. I would like to tell the Nigerian government, particularly the Adamawa State government, that any amount of money spent in an attempt to resuscitate our failed educational system, if the welfare of the primary school teachers is not put into consideration, it's a waste. This is Dr. Adamare Fata from Gombe Local Government Area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. More than 1 million children have had their education interrupted by the conflict in and around Nigeria, adding to the 11 million children who already are out of school in the region. More than 2,000 schools across Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger have closed since the beginning of the Boko Haram insurgency, which has destabilized the region and displaced millions, the United Nations Children's Fund said on Monday. Opposition activists in Djibouti say as many as 19 people were killed on Monday when security forces opened fire on a religious gathering in the capital. Witnesses said the troops targeted a crowd in the Balbala neighborhood that was commemorating the late religious leader Sheikh Yunus Musa. Security forces raided the venue at around 5 a.m. local time. That is it for this Tuesday, December 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Koch, I'm James Barty wishing you a lovely day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lino Modu discusses with medical experts the sexually transmitted diseases. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call in during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.